the Bungie Kids. With plasma pistols glowing, it's our podcast show. With Brian and friends.
And Frankie. Welcome back to the Bungie podcast. It's actually a few weeks after GDC, but for us as we record this, it's still kind of fresh in our mind. And we have a special guest today. We have Mr. Chris Butcher, engineering lead from Bungie Studios and a longtime Bungie alumnus.
Hi, guys.
How's it going? We also have Luke Smith, of course, as usual. Sketch is going to be joining us later, we think.
Yeah, he's trapped in Marty's office right now.
And I'm Frank O'Connor. So, Chris, you are our special guest. We've been trying to get you on the show now for months, right?
Yeah. He's a busy guy.
He's a very busy guy. Chris has helped lead Bungie through the process of divestiture from Bungie and also helped finish Halo 3 and is now working on lots of top secret stuff, but you just got back from GDC.
Yeah, I think you mean divestiture from Microsoft.
What did I say, Bungie?
Yeah.
Well, that's another plan we haven't discussed. Yeah.
Chris, make sure you sit closer to your mic because otherwise it'll be hard to hear you. You got to just kind of be up on it.
Yeah. But GDC, how was it?
It was really good. I was speaking at GDC this year, but I was lucky because I was talking on the first day of the conference rather than the last day of the conference. There's nothing worse than having to give a talk on the last day of the conference because every night, you know, you have to sit there and work on your presentation and polish it and practice it, and you have no time to go and do anything else.
And get rid of the things that other people said, right, that you were going to hope to present as your big new idea.
No. We always have the big new ideas, Frank. Come
on. No, we were just looking at a bunch of storytelling, actually, stuff over the last week or so, and a lot of people were hitting the same notes and time again, and I can just imagine those guys going through exactly what you said, which is sitting in their hotel room and saying, damn it, I was going to say that. Now I have to rethink the whole thing.
Well, it's pretty interesting. There's a little bit of convergence in the industry, not in terms of the games that we're making, but in terms of people's approaches to making games. I think it's fantastic. Where the industry is at right now, you know, there's a lot of biz stuff like consolidation of publishers and what have you. But if you just look at the games themselves, people are kind of done with the dealing with the console transition now. Generally speaking, everybody understands Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 and what it means to make games this generation. And so people are really starting to do some very interesting things, you know, things that would have been considered kind of experimental, like lots of procedural generation of content in games, or really interesting online multiplayer mechanics, or people experimenting with what it means to do storytelling in games. The kinds of things that you don't really see much experimentation with around the time of a console transition, where really it's just the big name franchises hitting out with their new one for this console, or it's you know, everybody's first game on the console. So they want to kind of take less risks with the structure of the game because they're taking a lot of technology risks. You know, now the technology risks are seen as not being as great, so people are putting bigger and bigger bets behind what is the kind of game we're making now.
Do you get the feeling that that sense of industry-wide reflection is sort of concentrated right now? I'm certainly getting that feeling that people are really examining what it is they do and what it is that games are. Am I imagining that just because it's so close to GDC and this is typical, or do you think that's really happening?
Well, GDC is definitely the time of the year when that happens. And one thing I think is interesting is that GDC has always been that time of the year for game developers, but now it's also that time of the year for the media as well, because typically the media around GDC time wasn't really doing much except looking forward to E3 and what are the big PR scoops going to be. But now at this time of the year, you know, all the media was at GDC and they got to do a lot of thinking about what is game design actually mean and where is it going. So you're seeing a lot more of that bouncing back in the media. And for somebody, you know, you guys obviously are part of the media, even though you're internal to our studio, you know, it's something you're probably thinking a lot more about around GDC time now.
I think that one of the other reasons that the media is so concentrated on GDC right now is that they're not quite sure what E3 is going to be anymore. And I don't think there's that sense of reliance on one big event during the year to concentrate on. So I think they try and parse as much from each of these smaller events as they possibly can.
You know what? I'm really looking forward to Penny Arcade Expo this year. I think it is going to be insanely big.
I think that the big boost for them is going to be media coverage of it. I mean, they're definitely going to get the consumers that they want there, which is the whole point of the show. But I think that there's a huge untapped swell of consumers out there that just don't know about Penny Arcade Expo. And once they are educated to that, and once this thing starts to become an event like Comic-Con or bigger, I think it's really going to be something. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, E3 going away has had a lot of really surprising consequences on the industry as a whole. I think that E3 really was an event for business, about the business of games. And now the events are kind of going in two directions. One is about the art and the craft of making games, of game development, which is GDC. And the other is the entertainment pleasure of consuming games. You know, shows like Penny Arcade Expo are a good example of that. So there's kind of a little bit of a bifurcation of that market, where we were all focused on the flash and the marketing and the selling of games. Now we're a lot more focused on what it means to create games and what it means to experience games. I think ultimately, you know, the flash and sizzle of marketing is really important, but everybody realizes that it was too much at the foreground.
I think that the idea that E3 was a trade show was kind of illusory anyway, because ostensibly it's a gathering place for retail buyers to come and see your wares, decide what they're going to buy that year, decide what's going to be big that year. And yet the irony was that they did that, and they made a lot of those decisions by measuring people's reaction, consumers' reaction to those video games during E3. A lot of them they would try and bump their meetings to later in the show so that they could see how the public had reacted to certain unveilings. And I always thought it was kind of ironic that games at E3 are presented in a fashion that's best suited to consumer digestion of them, and consumers weren't allowed in the show.
Well, I don't think we've figured out yet really what the right way is for games to announce and unveil to the public. Like, there was the previous E3 model of go big and have a trailer or a theater on the floor, you know, kind of the Halo 2 model. And then now there's kind of this open question, what is the best way for you to announce your game now? No one really knows. And I don't think we're going to see any standardization on it until digital distribution kind of hits a little bit more of the mainstream. Is these days, I kind of feel like one of the best ways to announce your game is just to prepare a bunch of information and just for the developer to be able to sit down and say, here's like the great stuff that we want to unveil to people on a variety of different levels. Like, yes, here's the big trailer that's really exciting, but also like, here's all the little information behind the scenes. Here's the backstory. Here's this tapestry. And it's really important for people like us, because we have the Bungie fan community. It's such a huge resource of people who love to find out more in depth about what we do. And I think it's really interesting to see a lot more people in the industry starting to consider, you know, how can we talk about our games in a more nuanced fashion? One of the games I think is really interesting is Too Human. I'm a big Too Human fan, which is kind of an unpopular position in the industry at the moment. But I really like the game a lot. And I think it's fascinating what they're doing with the way they're kind of trying to relaunch the game. They're doing it on many levels at once, with like the big PR blitz and the developer diaries and really detailed features and stuff on their website. Like, you kind of are presenting the smorgasbord that consumers can understand. You know, how much do I really care about this game? Do I care a little bit about it? Do I care a lot about it? Do I just want to see something pretty and then forget about it? There's many different levels of engagement.
And they have a difficult logistical challenge because they suffered kind of a delay, and that delay affects perception as well. People forget about things, so they have to refresh consumers about what to expect from that game. I happen to be looking forward to it as well. So,
yeah, I think it's coming out in third quarter is what it says on GameSpot, but I don't know.
Sure. I thought it was fall in 08, something like that.
I think it's June.
June?
It's May
summer?
Or June, I think, yeah.
Right.
I think it's earlier than later.
We can just ask someone later.
Yeah, we can ask an adult.
Yeah, we'll ask a grown up.
To transition away from some of the industry specific stuff, I do want to talk a little bit about what Chris talked about at GDC specifically. And some folks have probably checked out the presentation, which is available now on Bungie Publications on BungieNet. But Chris, your presentation was focused pretty specifically on matchmaking. And what were you trying to ultimately convey to your average attendee?
Well, talks at GDC are interesting. There's almost every talk at GDC has kind of an ulterior motive behind it, right? Some people are talking at GDC because they want to convey how smart they are. Some people are talking at GDC because they've heard it's a good way for them to raise their profile internal to their company. You know, like, well, I'm going to talk at GDC because that makes me a higher priority guy, so maybe I'll get promoted in my company. But really, the reason that I wanted to talk about the matchmaking at GDC is kind of evangelism, because, you know, we feel like the matchmaking experience in Halo is kind of seen as this strange thing that's outside the norm for the industry, and we don't really think it needs to be that way. I mean, it is a fair amount of work to build a matchmaking infrastructure, but, you know, people would always come up to me after the show. I mean, in this regard, I guess my talk failed, but they come up to me after my talk and say, wow, that sounds like a huge amount of work. You know, I'm not sure we have time for that. But the message I was trying to convey was, matchmaking really is a very simple idea. It has some complex consequences you have to consider, but you can build a matchmaking model into your game, and it doesn't have to be as complex as Halo. I mean, clearly the Infinity Ward guys understand this, for example. Like, they have matchmaking in Call of Duty 4, and it, you know, it works very well with their game, and they didn't try and do every single little thing that exists in Halo 3, but they clearly were able to pull it off still.
Well, I think one of the things that, ironically, people like about Call of Duty 4's matchmaking is it is a little more focused than ours. There's slightly less breadth to it, and people are pretty much enjoying the focus of that kind of funneling system that their matchmaking does.
Yeah, and you could argue that Halo 3's online experience has so many pieces to it that no one person out there, like, does everything in Halo 3. I think that's absolutely true. You could argue that there could have been a little bit more focus there.
Yeah. I think that's it's one of the challenges we're going to have ongoing. But you're effectively suggesting that if people like the matchmaking system, and I mean our rivals and our competitors, they should maybe emulate aspects of it that they like and not worry about that. I mean, if you're evangelizing the idea of it broadly, aren't you suggesting that they ape it in some ways?
Yeah, absolutely. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, the playlist system, which is kind of controversial. Like, a lot of people, even in the community, you know, still are not a big fan of playlists. Well, fair enough, you know.
Right.
The playlist system where everything is controlled centrally is what we chose to do for Halo because there's such a tremendous variety of game settings out there that it'd be very, very difficult to search based on, like, an actual game setting. Like, I really want to search for an infection game, you know, on this map with this starting weapon and the zombies move X fast. Like, you can't really search for that. But you could imagine building a matchmaking system kind of in isolation from many of the other Halo ideas, like the skill system and playlists and the party system. It's not a single idea. Really what it is rather than forcing players to join up into groups manually, let's give them a system whereby they can be placed into groups automatically. And just that statement has got nothing to do with, you know, rematch or ranked play or social play or my opponents have to be anonymous or anything like that. It's just an idea that you can combine with many other elements to kind of make up the online experience as a whole. And yeah, I think there are many, many situations. Like, I talked about how maybe you could use it in a real-time strategy game, and in fact we see Blizzard has done similar things in the past successfully. Or you could use it embedded in some other system. For example, you have a massively multiplayer game and there's some system there where you could use a matchmaking-like experience in the auction house. So you're kind of matchmaking people into small groups where now they get to haggle in a one-on-one environment with each other. You know, it can be applied to many situations that aren't necessarily obvious. And that's what GDC is all about, is finding interesting techniques that you can take and then reapply to your own specific problems. That's really what I was trying to do there.
To move on from GDC and to move back, do you remember a few months ago when Dave Dunn came on the podcast and he tried to tell stories about you from your youth?
I do remember hearing that Dave was talking on the podcast. I don't think I actually listened to the Dave podcast.
I think you rolled out the old sleeping on the soccer field chestnut. That's a favorite. What else were the other ones?
That's the one that I think that was the specific Butcher-related call.
I think Dave also, if memory serves me right, had some crazy sitcom that he was always trying to joke about with Alex Seropian, where he was pitching himself as
This sounds good.
Familiar, yeah.
Or he was like was he Mr. Belvedere-esque, like the crazy butler?
Yeah, well, I think Dave's already told this story, so I won't go into it in detail. But basically, Dave Dunn's always liked to horse around a little bit. And I was pretty young when I first joined Bungie. I was, 21? I was the youngest person at Bungie by a good year or two at the time. And Dave was kind of like my older, like, brother, educating me in the ways of, not only... the United States, but also just like, what does it mean to live in this crazy world we live in?
Oh, no. Oh, wow. That's like, that's the blind leading the blind there. Yeah. Dave Dunn should not be anyone's mentor for life.
Well, but no, Dave is a really nice guy. Like, I went to my first ever Super Bowl party at his place, and he made me, we decided it was time to watch some good old American movies. So we watched Born on the 4th of July and Red Dawn in order to inculcate me into what it really meant to be an American.
I think you're seeing where this has gone and what Chris has become in a very real way. But, I mean, true, Dave is a generous, kind-hearted, warm human being and a proud American, and he often dresses like a woman.
That is true, and in fact is quite scary when he does dress like a woman.
Yeah, it's not attractive. It's not like a crying game where you could be confused or frightened.
No, you full-on realize that's a dude with heels.
Yeah, it's just a dude with heels on. It's awful.
So when you first came to Bungie, how was Bungie different then versus how it is now? It's a pretty different place, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. I think a lot of the culture of Bungie has existed and been very similar right since day one when I first joined. I came to Bungie for the first time back at the start of 2000, so about 8 years ago. This was about 6 months before Microsoft acquired Bungie, and I was working in the Bungie West offices in San Jose. I was working on Oni. And there was a lot of, a lot of humor and horsing around, but really, like, the scrappy underdog was the theme of the day. Like, people forget how much of a total unknown and underdog Bungie was back in early 2000. I mean, there was a movie out there about some game, Halo, that looked like it was pretty cool, like, maybe even as good as Tribes. And, there was a lot of good feeling in the Bungie community, which was a fraction of the size it is today. But really, compared to all the big PlayStation games and things like that, if you had said back then, oh, Bungie's going to make a game that's going to be competing head-to-head with Nintendo's big franchises, people would have looked at you and said, what the hell are you thinking? There's been just a scale change of two orders of magnitude and expectation. And it's a real challenge, because now in many ways we've always been the scrappy underdog internally here in a lot of ways. We're always trying to do things that are a little bit beyond our reach in terms of we want to stay small, we want to stay creative, and we want every individual to have a big impact on the final product. We don't want to have teams of 150 and 180 people making gigantic games. And so we always are trying to stretch things a little bit further than they really will go. And now that we're independent again, that spirit is kind of back in full force. There's always going to be that feeling of, well, how can we make this dollar go a little bit further? I remember Alex Seropian, like, he used to have Bagel Fridays in the Chicago office where he would order in bagels from a local place, and then everybody in the company would get bagels, and they could just have them in the kitchen. Well, in the Bungie West office, we had a similar kind of thing, except we're getting, like, bagel dogs and all kinds of different chocolate milk and stuff like that. It was really quite lavish. But then Seropian came out to Bungie West but in order to help us finish, the last mile on Oni, and he was there for a couple months. And then, I noticed, the lavish spreads we had on Fridays may be a little less lavish. Alex was never one to spend a dollar when he could spend 25 cents and get something that was almost as good. And, bless the guy, he and Jason managed to keep Bungie afloat for many years on I don't know how. I mean, I remember being there when they were like, Myth Total Codex passed 100,000 sales. Can you believe like what a gigantic windfall that is for our company? Bungie stayed alive for so many years on just tiny revenues. And I like to think there's a bit of that spirit here today still. I mean, it's hard when we have, you know, a power budget just for electricity in this building that is more than Bungie's entire operations for the first 6 years of its life.
We do have some big air conditioners. It's true.
Wow, that's a fun fact. Yeah. I had no idea.
Well, top tip.
Well, that's also, like a ballpark.
We also have lavish bagel buffets every Friday with chocolate cakes and vitamin water.
I remember when I first started on Bagel Fridays, Butcher saw me downstairs and he said, "Why are you don't have a bagel?" He's like, "You gotta have a bagel dog on Friday. That's how you gotta roll."
Yeah, so I can't eat a bagel dog. They're obscene. I just don't make me uncomfortable.
Sometimes it does feel a little early for a bagel dog on Friday.
But it's kind of funny these days. I mean, we try not to spend gargantuan amounts on snacks because it does get out of control sometimes, particularly during crunch, you know, when every single team member is going to walk by the kitchen and take three or four snacks on the way back to their desk. You know, you go through hundreds of pounds of food pretty quickly.
You do the math, though. That's a lot cheaper than overtime. It's a lot cheaper than extra employees. Keep them here for 18 hours. Give them a bagel dog. Save yourself $50 an hour.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's not about the free food and the free snacks, right? Like, what it's really about is the going back to your desk and sitting down and seeing the guy next to you working on something awesome that's going to make the game way better than it was the day before. That's what keeps people motivated. And the mounds and mounds of free food just go directly to people's waistlines and don't make them happy. So we scale back a little bit on the free food.
Yeah, I try and save money where we can, but that's because I'm Scottish, so we're naturally tight-fisted skinflints. Like Mr. Seropian, a good-natured, good-hearted skinflint.
I don't even know what a skinflint is. It's like, is that an older thing?
You're Chris Butch is a Kiwi. You use the expression skinflint, surely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it means tight-fisted.
Okay. I'm sorry, I've just never heard it before, that's all.
It means a little miserly.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm cheap.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But yeah, I mean, one of the things that we've had as a disadvantage in recent years, I think, is people's natural association that we're part of a multi-billion dollar corporation. We're, you know, obviously we're not literally now, but I don't think we ever were culturally part of a big machine. We were always a fairly small, lean studio. And to Chris's point, we ran our team smaller than we could have. We could have made a much bigger team. But there's something to be said about keeping it lean and close.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it is a little bit hard now after independence readjusting people's expectations where it's like, no, listen, we're not going to upgrade everybody's work machines once every year and a half. I know that your code is compiling a little bit slower than it used to, but we're going to have a budget and we're going to be recycling these PCs through because we don't get free machines from the Xbox Live data center anymore, right? So there's a little bit of expectation adjustment there. But on the whole, I think it's working out really well. I mean, we're trying to strike the right balance between giving people the tools they need to do their job and realizing that not being part of Microsoft anymore means that we're taking a lot of these risks on our own
right
now.
And, for an equitable share in the rewards for everyone, we should be lean. I mean, I think the policy of medicine just for your oldest child is perfectly fair and people will get used to it and they'll have one really strong older child. No, I mean, I haven't noticed much difference in the day-to-day operations, but I have noticed that that it feels kind of fresh and unburdened in a very tangible way. Day to day, we're still having our lavish bagel feasts, but I do feel this sort of lightening of the load in terms of the mythical oppressive shadow of a giant corporation. Microsoft was always very nice to work with, but it does feel very different now.
I think I really feel like the culture here at Bungie is kind of springing back from the roots. There's like an overall greening. It's spring again after, you know, not necessarily a winter, but a little bit of a cold snap culturally. You know, towards the very end. And part of that is inevitable because, you know, we're getting to the point where Microsoft's objectives for Halo and Bungie's objectives for making the games we want to make, I mean, they're always aligned, but that alignment was starting to get more and more difficult towards the end. And now we're in a position, I think, where Microsoft's objectives and our objectives are aligned again exactly correctly in the sense that we're going to make the games that will best serve our objectives and we're going to fit into their portfolio in a way that they understand and is well-defined as a third-party developer. I mean, Microsoft is still a great partner to work with, and I don't think we'd ever choose to work with anybody else, but the real difference now is that they understand how to deal with us and we understand how to deal with them in a structured way.
I think, speaking of that relationship and the sort of the mutual benefits of that relationship, one Chris fact that people probably don't know is Chris has actually contributed a lot to both the Xbox Live platform and the Xbox hardware platform over the years, certainly just in terms of discussions and meetings, but probably some pretty specific things too.
Yeah, I can't talk very much about the specifics of the hardware design because obviously that's about as secret as stuff gets.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Xbox hardware design group has always been really interested in talking to game developers about exactly how they use the hardware and the software platform and what the best things are that they can do. And obviously, you know, all the challenges actually making the hardware work are completely things that we don't know anything about. I mean, we don't really have electrical engineers or thermal architects here at Bungie or people who are really awesome at figuring out, you know, exactly how many dollars and cents every component makes up that goes into the box. But one of the things that we were able to provide for them was just a kind of an understanding of, you know, in the end, here's what this feature is really going to mean for the games. And so it was really fascinating to get involved in those kinds of discussions about, well, how much memory should the Xbox have? And, well, is it better for it to have a unified memory architecture or split between the CPU addressable and video RAM? And exactly what kinds of texture formats should the box have and which ones are most useful? And it was really good to be able to sit down and sit around the table with them about that.
See, I mean, it seems obvious to me as a layman that kind of collaborative effort is one of the reasons why. And I'm sorry for the console wars talk, but that's one of the reasons why the 360 must be the platform of choice for developers. I don't think many people would argue it isn't.
No, absolutely. And the thing is that, I mean, every console manufacturer, you know, Sony, Nintendo, you know, even Intel and Microsoft on the PC side, you know, obviously go and talk to game developers and find out what they want, but it's often quite late in the process. One of the things that was really interesting about the design of Xbox One and Xbox 360 is very, very early on, right from the fundamental design stage of the console, the question was, well, how is this going to work for game developers? And let's go find a bunch of game developers and specifically sit them down with these questions. And it informs every part of the hardware and software design of the Xbox 360.
I guess the flip side of that, and you know, one of the places you get pushback is obviously if a video game developer designed a console, it would be like, you know, the Homer 5000 from The Simpsons, where it has everything on it. You know, yes, it has both unified architecture and it has extra graphics processors and a physics processor and 10 hard drives. And I mean, that must be a weird to and fro, especially when you look at things like optional hard drive, for example. That must have been a tough battle to kind of talk through, at least.
Well, not necessarily. I think one of the things that's really fascinating about that was that Microsoft's got a really large portfolio of developers who care about a lot of different things. And I thought it was fascinating talking, you know, during that early stage with some of the guys from Rare who were saying, you know, listen, we don't want to load the console up with all of these bells and whistles because it's really important that we need to be able to make a console that we can sell to a lot of people. Right. You know, like, if you're going to buy a console for games that your kids are going to play on it, you're not going to want to spend $600 on it. And it's really important that we're able to hit that price point. So a lot of ways, there was pressure from the game developers to say, listen, you know, getting a high install base is king, so we understand that, you know, you can't put a gigabyte of memory in it. That's okay. We're prepared to deal with that. And lots of other trade-offs, large and small.
I hadn't actually really thought of a demographic disparity between developers, but of course it's there, especially in the Xbox Live catalog and the sort of advent of mainstream gaming. Which sort of, you know, earlier on you were talking about the differences between PS3 and 360 and talking about how now that a lot of the basically technical challenges are at least established and we kind of know how to make video games that we weren't we weren't concentrating so much on innovation in that space and removing our innovation and self-reflection to other areas. But what about things like Wii, where they completely reset the balance of necessities for a game? How do you feel about that as an engineer, but also as a game designer?
You know, I'm not a huge fan of the Wii, mostly because I'm not convinced that the motion control capabilities really bring a lot to the experience that is mitigated by the fact that there's just a tremendous variety of experiences that you cannot have at all on the Wii. I mean, there are many, many classes of games that you just can't do on the Wii, whether it's a game like Assassin's Creed that has got a city full of people you can interact with, or anything like, you know, Grand Theft Auto 4. Talk about the range of experiences you can have in that game, or even, you know, the later of the GTA series on the PS2 and the Xbox One. A lot of those games would be very difficult to port to the Wii, simply because it's not designed to create those immersive, detailed simulations. Now, I've had the chance to play a bunch of games that I think are really well tailored to the Wii, and you know they're great games, and they are really interesting, and they explore the possibility space of games in ways that we haven't been able to up until this point. But when I ask myself the question, is this getting us closer to the future and close to what the ultimate potential of video games is to change, you know, everything from education to culture to art? You know, I don't think so. So I think in that regard, it's an evolutionary side shoot that's interesting, but ultimately is going to die off.
Do you think that you would be saying the same thing about that if the Wii had launched as a graphical powerhouse, a 360 or a PS3, but with those motion controls?
Well, it's not about graphical powerhouse or not. It's about not having any focus on social gaming, really. I mean, it's very difficult to actually play multiple players on the Wii. It's a real challenge because you're managing many, many different types of remotes and nunchucks. You know, the online friend codes are very difficult to manipulate. And I'm not trying to bash Nintendo here at all, just saying that when I think about the things that excite me for the future, it's connected entertainment and it's really detailed simulation. You know, I'm not talking about photorealistic graphics here, but just the kinds of things you can do and the kinds of worlds you can explore. You know, all of those are clearly not the focus for the Wii.
Well, since Sketch hasn't come back yet, I actually figured he'd be here by now. He always asks when we have guests on, he always asks a couple of questions. And so I guess I'll fill in the void. He always wants to know, what are five of your favorite games that are not Bungie games, but five of like your all-time favorite video games?
Well, that's actually pretty interesting. Starting from games I can remember back in the day. Sketch is just coming in to join us now.
No, I have it all set up.
Yeah. Luke just stole your question. He's asking Chris what his favorite games are.
But that's okay. You can ask it.
Marty Principal?
Yeah, so I tried to ask.
Fine, I hadn't.
I tried to even sound really laconic when I asked, so it would be like a full recreation of you, but I couldn't do it. So you should ask Chris your question.
What?
You know, the question you always ask everyone.
Hey, how you doing, by the way, Chris?
I'm doing great, Brian. Nice of you to join us.
Hey, so one of the questions that we often ask our Bungie visitors are list off some of your all-time favorite games. Help us understand you as a gamer.
Wow. Well, I'll start with some of the early games I really loved.
Oh, sorry, Bungie games excluded because they would totally fill out the whole list.
Yeah, we've been there already. Yeah.
No, it's better when he does
it. It is, but...
You know, I played a game called Millennium 2.2 back on the Amiga. This was probably back in like 89 or like 92, something like that, really early. This was a game where like the Earth had been destroyed by some horrible nuclear conflict, and you were the commander of Moonbase, and you had like 100 people, and you were trying to rebuild an industrial civilization from scratch, and you had to like go and colonize other planets and figure out what was going on. And I loved it because I've always been like both one, a huge sci-fi nerd, and two, just a gigantic pessimist for the ways we're going to destroy ourselves with technology. And it was a really fun game. I was probably like 10 years old. I
was going to say, was that like an edutainment title or something? Because I played something called Oregon Trail that sounded similar.
No. Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd have like all of these graphs of like here's all the planets in the solar system and the resources of like rubidium and copper and titanium on each planet you could find. So then I'd know the exact optimal strategy to go colonize the solar system. And I always used to like make charts of games and like try and reverse engineer the design of the games and just like write down like my own little mini FAQs, because this is before the time of the internet, right? You'd go and look this stuff up online. So if you wanted to play a game, you have to write down everything you needed to know how to play the game properly.
Oh yes, so. the notes section in the back of the manual.
You know, one of these days I'll have to bring in some of my stuff. It's pretty awesome, like 10 and 11 year old butchers like scribblings of what the game design is.
Some of it might end up being a prototype. You have to be careful who you show it to.
Soon to be a AAA blockbuster.
And so the next one is Eye of the Beholder 2. Oh, I love the Eye of the Beholder games. Like you get out you're in first person in like a dungeon that's made up of 10 by 10 foot squares on the ground, and you've got your party of adventurers and it's Dungeons and Dragons, and you're like fighting monsters and moving around and picking up loot, and you're in a dungeon and it's like a maze, so you have to map out the maze. So I'd have all of these graph paper maps of like every level of the dungeon and where all the items were and stuff like that.
Is anyone else disturbed that Butcher's describing primitive games, but he's describing what I thought of as futuristic 3D games at the time?
They were futuristic in 3D. I mean, another good one is Ultima Underworld, right? Like, predates Doom, but full 6 degree of freedom, full parallax texture mapping, like a physics engine in a game back in, what, 1993? I love that stuff. One of my good friends who I met at GDC just this time, he is working on what he considers to be a spiritual successor to Ultima Underworld. It's like a pet project of his. But, you know, technology has advanced so far today that you can do with one person what took a whole team back then.
The Lord British Chronicles? I'm way off.
Let it warm up a little bit.
I'm in the wrong seat. Like, I'm coming in late.
Just no champagne.
Let it
warm
up.
Where's the bubbly?
Let it warm up.
Sorry, Brian. Lord British was in Ultima Underworld 2.
All right. Well, there you go.
So let me see. Those are three really good ones. What are some other awesome ones? You know, I loved the original System Shock. Love that game. So good. You can kind of tell, like, all of these, like, old school, like, really old Western RPGs are kind of the ones I used to love. Like, you won't find Dragon Quest or anything like that on my list, because I didn't have access to all of those kinds of games. Not so much, just more like the PC and Amiga, you know, software front. But let's see, other fantastic games of all time that I've played recently. You know, I really liked Mass Effect. I think it's up there in my top 10 of all time.
Really? Bigger than KOTOR?
I think it is slightly below KOTOR 1, but only very, very slightly. I think the setting is much better than Knights of the Old Republic. I think the combat was not very good. I just didn't feel like it was really ready. But clearly they had a lot of time to work on it. They just wanted to be done with it so they could move on to the others, I think.
I like the combat in Mass Effect because I can't stand the combat in other RPGs.
What about you? Did you play much KOTOR?
Yeah, I tried. Oh. Yeah, much is relative.
So,
for
I was going to say, let's keep in mind who we're
15,
talking.
15 through 20 minutes.
You gave that game a 10 for OXM, right?
I didn't review
game
it.
Of the year?
I can't review RPGs. There's no way.
No, I loved Knights of the Old Republic. It was really, really good.
Yep.
But one of the reasons I cite Mass Effect, you know, almost as high in my book, is because I just love the setting. I mean, I was one of those people who pre-ordered the prequel novel off Amazon and read it cover to cover in a single evening. I just love worlds where there's that texture and richness and depth of character and theme and faction. And so I just ate that stuff up in Mass Effect. You know, and it's something I've always loved about Bungie games as well. I know we're not meant to be talking about Bungie games, but, you know, I got to say Marathon 2 right up there, you know, in my top five.
But you were a fan of Marathon 2. You didn't work at Bungie at that time.
Oh, no, I wasn't. I was... Yeah. This was back when I was at university. We would play Marathon, like, all day... you know, every single day, late into the night, after we'd finished like working on all of our projects in Turbo Pascal, we'd sit down and play a Marathon into the night.
On an Apple Talk network in the... Yeah.
Yeah, the best part about that was you've got an Apple Talk network in the university campus, and it wasn't like, you know, host game, join game. it was where you, when you wanted to join the game, you'd click the button that says "I'm ready to join," and then one guy would like go see everybody who was waiting on the network and click on them and like scoop them into his game. So the most favorite sport ever was to like go to all the other AppleTalk networks in the campus and try and find people who are like waiting for someone else's game and like grab them and scoop them into your game instead.
System link burglary.
And then systematically beat on them until they quit. That was the best part.
Just like early griefing. Very nice.
Huh. Sort of like when you join a Bungie guys party in Halo 3 and they don't close it, and then like 5 seconds later 13 other random people come in and it's mass chaos.
I can name them right now if you like.
So it seems, would it be fair to say that if you had to lean towards one genre exclusively, that you seem to be more a sci-fi guy than anything else?
Kind of. I love games that you can really take and just explore the world and the setting, and it's got lots of different paths through it. Like, I love Civilization in all of its forms because it's a game you can keep coming back to over and over and over again. Mostly what I love are games that kind of challenge the player to fill in the blanks, you know, where it's not like you're just going A, B, C, D, E, F. You're choosing what is the most meaningful thing to you in the game, and then you're imbuing that with your own feelings about it. That's why I'm always attracted to the online side of Halo, because you're creating your own experience with everybody around you, you know, whether it's Griff Ball or whatever.
There was a period of time, if I recall, in the not too distant past when you were actually quite active playing World of Warcraft.
Yeah, I played World of Warcraft for, let's see, it was a little over a year. I think I got into it right around Christmas of 2004, right after we shipped Halo 2.
Yep.
And then I played for...
It was around the same time that I got pulled in as well. All the lunchtime conversations that you guys were having every single day.
So I played for about 15 months. I was on Ferex's server. You know, he still runs that guild on that server.
He does.
I won't name it.
I took a break for like 9 months. I assumed the guild had gone to hell and everything fell apart. I came back. It's bigger than ever.
That's crazy.
Still going strong.
Yeah, and like in
people
fact,
people still ask occasionally, "Whatever happened to that?"
Bro? I was at GDC and I ran into one of the guys from Freeverse who did the marathon Durandal port to Xbox Live Arcade, and it was pretty surreal because I had only ever met him in World of Warcraft before. Yep. And
a hot elf chick?
He was not a hot elf chick.
He was there in cosplay. Yeah, at GDC.
It was Dave Dunn.
Actually, we were a horde. They didn't have elves back then, so come on.
Oh, I have no idea what you're talking
Interestingly
about.
Interestingly enough, the entire Marathon 2 project and relationship with Freeverse all stemmed from interactions in Warcraft.
Oh, wow.
Seriously, it was. He chatted me, "Hey, you guys ever thought about making Marathon? We think it'd be cool. We don't have the time." "Oh, well, we'd love to do it. We did it and got it running up for fun. You guys can check it out," and there you go.
Yeah, World of Warcraft is a great game. I like to joke with Jamie Griesmer sometimes that World of Warcraft is a superset of all game design. And it really kind of is, because it is such a large, constructed piece of art that, from a design standpoint, I mean, every game design, every game mechanic in that game is really well polished, because they've just iterated on it endlessly over and over and over for, what, 4 years or something, when you take into account all of the alpha and beta period. It's a tremendously polished game, but it's also very, very broad. It's a game that really attempts to be all things to all people, because they're trying to create a world that has enough stuff in it that you can justify spending 20 hours a week in it for the rest of your life.
It's remarkably noob-friendly as well, I'll be honest. Even, you know, I hate RPGs, but I was able to find my way around until I got ejected. And, but there was stuff to do, even for me. I didn't want to level up. I didn't want to do any of the things they wanted me to do.
Yeah, you were fishing.
But I could just go explore.
You were
like,
cooking
I could go
and
under
fishing.
The bridge and follow that big giant thing around. It wouldn't talk to me. You know?
You know Luke's a Scarab Lord, right? There was a time when that actually meant a lot in Warcraft, like pre-patch days.
Luke, but you have the Elite Scarab Mount.
I do. I have the from completing the Scepter line and opening the gates of Ankaraj. Yep, I did all that. I was the guy on my server.
Clearly, that was when you had too much time on your hands back before you joined Bungie.
Oh,
that
was
it was when I worked at Kotaku, actually, because I could just write everything I need to write in about an hour and play WoW the rest of the time.
That explains a lot about that website.
Oh no, Butchie went there. I served it up, but I didn't think he's gonna go.
Only difference is now he plays Halo instead of instead of Warcraft. Still does an hour worth of writing.
I'm not leveling up anymore.
Yes. World of Warcraft and actually MMOs in general are a really interesting trap for game designers because it's very easy for a significant proportion of your game development team to play so much WoW outside of work that they tend to phrase a lot of stuff at work in terms of their thinking and they're relating to that experience. So that can be a real challenge.
What did you say the other day about something came up and you said I was going to crit some eyeballs?
Yeah, someone sent some like wall of text to email, and I was like, could you put some space breaks in there? You're critting eyeballs.
I don't know what you mean. I
know you were on the thread. It was like you, me,
yeah, I know,
Brian,
but I
and
didn't
Lars,
get the expression because
yeah,
I didn't hang just, out in Draconia or wherever you guys were at.
It was just for sketch.
You're right, though. I think something like that has a tendency to permeate and influence a lot of people, sometimes inadvertently. So.
But WoW is pretty much industry wide. I mean, that's
everyone's
this conversation
it or has
could happen
it.
To any yeah. any developer. Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, for a long time, Jason Jones was holding out and was not playing any World of Warcraft. But I finally convinced him he needs to play at least a little bit. So he started a character, and then like everybody else is like, oh, I want to come back and play as well. Oh my goodness!
And people put on bandanas.
Bandanas,
you know, to go play. Yeah. Like Francois,
yeah.
That's his
uniform.
Costume. Hmm.
It's not much of a costume, but it's there.
You don't want to tell everyone where Jason plays? I mean, everyone always says whenever there's a podcast thread,
what's his server and account name?
Yeah, I don't know. Man, I'm starting to regret, actually. Back when we were doing the making of documentary for Halo 3, I thought it would be super amusing if in the video documentary I was wearing my jacket that had my gamer tag on the left breast. That turned out to be a tactical mistake because you guys always said, man, you know, being called Frankie means you sure get a lot of friend requests, but you know, I didn't really anticipate exactly how many friend requests I get. Probably about 15 a day.
Just let it fill up. Keep it full.
Yeah.
You're safe.
Keep it at 100. Just delete a couple to make space every now and then.
It sucks because I want to tell everybody, hey, I appreciate you taking the time to track down my gamer tag. It's nice to talk to you, but really, I keep my friends list for my friends. Yep. But just everybody listening to the podcast, if you ever send a friend request to Butcher 2 and I was a jerk back to you and didn't answer you, it's not because I don't like you.
Yep, we've tried to go over this topic a lot. It's just the sheer volume that we all receive. We just don't have the time to personally, politely respond, even though we'd like to. It's just, 15 a day is pretty high. I'm sure these guys in the peak. If your list wasn't so full, you'd probably
that.
Yeah.
No, I get.
My message,
I get
my message queue
a day.
Is always maxed out. Yeah. The second I delete some, I get more good data because I don't have the ability to block still talk to people in custom games.
I'm just saying the pro tip. All you need to do is from Xbox.com, when you're done playing games for the night, change your setting to friends only. When you log back in to play Halo, set it to everyone so that while you're playing Halo, you can hear everyone and talk to everyone. And then once you're done, you're done. And
they know the second you pop up online, you start getting hit really hard.
That's when, then you set online presence to friend only. Mm. Like there's all kinds of measures you can take to not get inundated with 1,000 notifications.
I have certain rules and certain habits that I go through when I log in. One of the things that I was complaining to myself about was if you get 100 messages in Xbox Live and you use the X shortcut to delete them, sometimes it'll hang after like 6 or 7 of those because you're vidding the X button. Then I realized, well, typically people won't really have to do that because they're not going to get that many messages, I suppose. But then the other thing is, and this is again a sort of apology in advance, if you send me more than 5 consecutive messages, I just put you on block because you're filling up other people's opportunity to message us.
It's true.
Who I'm then also not going to have time to respond to. But 5, that's too many.
Well, a fascinating thing about this is that it shows how Xbox Live has just been so wildly successful. I mean, I don't know if you guys remember, but back before Halo 2 launched, there were all these statistics flying around about the average number of friends on people's friend list is 0.7, you know, and things like that. It was like, wow, you know, Xbox Live is not a very connected community. And in the 6 years since then, it's turned into a massively connected community. And those guys are really smart, and they do a lot of work to behind the scenes, like think about what they're going to do with the next version and change things. But it's such a hard problem because the scale of communication has increased dramatically. And in many ways, Xbox Live is actually a much harder problem than something like MySpace, because MySpace has got a very, very rich interaction metaphor with it. When you're sitting at a computer and you're actually sitting down, you're saying, okay, I'm going to spend time managing my friends list now, or I'm going to spend time replying to messages. When you're playing on your Xbox, anything you do in that regard is always going to feel like a chore, because if you're not spending time just playing games, you're going to say, oh, goddamn, this Xbox Live UI, I wish I didn't have to do this.
But I do like those natural breaks where, you know, you're waiting for matchmaking in a lobby. You can just go delete some messages, send a couple, look for an invite. You know, there's some natural breaks in the normal order of play, loading and so on, that let you do some of that management in a casual fashion.
Yeah, and it's really exciting. I don't know if you guys remember, like on Xbox One, what a gigantic pain in the ass it was to do anything with Xbox Live, because the dashboard was a totally separate executable you had to boot out to. It was really hard to access. Yeah. And yeah. I don't remember.
I remember it was green.
This is the first time, this is the first time I've thought about it in a long time, though.
Yeah, right. It used to be.
But so the underlying reason behind
at the
that
time,
is
it was
because,
still awesome compared to like the cumbersome PC experience that you had to go through in a lot of other games, but.
Yeah, or I was an early adopter of the PlayStation 2 online network, and that was really hard to use as well. But one of the things that's really fascinating is the reason that it's gotten better this generation by a lot is the software investment, but the reason that's possible is because the pace of expanding memory in the console and CPU power has gotten so great that like something as big as the Xbox One dashboard, you know, like a quarter of the size of that, like 16 megabytes, that's how big the fraction is, I think, for the Xbox 360 reservation for the system now. But that's now big enough they can devote it to the Blade and always be present. You know, for the next generation, the amount that's possible will expand even further. So over time, a lot of what we consider to be overhead that means you have to come out of the game experience now is going to eventually be integrated further and further and more tightly into games because it can all run concurrently. And, you know, when we talk to Microsoft about all their future plans, it's really, really awesome because that kind of generational leap is going to be able to keep happening again and again and again. I was at GDC, and I'm a huge believer in where like that none of us really even have any ability to comprehend what games are going to be like 20 years from now. So I went to Ray Kurzweil's keynote at the GDC where he was talking about the future of technology over the next 20 years and what that's going to mean for video games. Everybody in the audience just going, this guy's crazy. Nanobots in the bloodstream. What's that even going to be about? I was awesome. Just sitting there going, yes, bring it on.
I'll take some today.
Yeah, I want video some superpowers.
They're going to actually become Metal Gear.
Yeah.
No, we want the nanobots to go through and clean the chalupas out of our arteries.
That is not what nanobots are for.
They could certainly do that very effectively, I might add.
Yeah, but there's all this really, really cool stuff that's going to be possible.
That's another question, actually, that you bring that up that we tend to ask a lot of our guests is just prophesize for us. Where is the industry headed just pie in the sky? Where do you see the biggest evolutions happening for games?
Oh, wow. I mean, I actually spoke to someone from MSNBC about this about a month ago. She was doing a piece on the future of video games and where are they going. And so leaving aside all the really interesting stuff about the art and craft of video games and, you know, expanding team sizes and higher fidelity of simulation, I think the interface to games is going to be tremendously different 10 years from now. I mean, we're going to be able to have displays that feel integrated with our awareness of the world rather than something that's on a screen that we're watching. Maybe that means head-mounted displays. Maybe that means that video games, all video games, will be portable. Like, at some point, there won't be a video game console that you sit in your living room because it won't make any sense. It'll be integrated with your mobile phone, or it'll be something you carry around with you, or it'll be in your head. And that's only 10 or 15 years away. There won't be any electronic devices as physical objects that you pick up and cart around to your friend's house 15 years from now. That won't exist. They will all be part of us. And what that's going to be like is going to be pretty incredible.
Wow.
I mean, if anybody's listening to this podcast,
I agree with you in terms of what will be possible, but not on how infrastructures and systems are. I mean, that we still have CRTs on sale in stores right now. Some of that stuff is institutional and hard to get rid of, even when it's outlived its usefulness. And I think we'll still be – certainly in America, we have some real infrastructure problems to solve for things like broadband, for example.
I'm not denying, Frank, that you will probably still be watching Laserdiscs in the year 2030. However
– your HD DVD collection the
world will have passed you by. And it's going to do it in a way that's just going to sweep everything else away. When you can carry in your pocket – any entertainment experience in the world, that is going to just
except usher. Crisis, right? You're still going to need a hefty rig for that.
Jeez. It'll run on your Zoom in that day and age.
But anybody who's really interested listening to this podcast and wants to go read about this and think, what would games be like? Like, there are two books I've read in the last year that, you know, both of them are written by science fiction writers. They're a little bit nutty. They're not really, like, actually what games will be like. But one of them is Halting State by Charles Stross, and the other is Rainbow's End by Werner Vinge. Both of those, I think, are the two clearest visions of what it means to be in this world where, you know, something like Xbox Live, but several orders of magnitude more advanced and more complicated, is now not something that you interact with on your PC. It's something that you're plugged into all the time if you want to be. It's something that's just part of the fabric that's connecting you together. Like, part of your daily feed of information or your minutely feed of information is going to be how are you connected to all of these game worlds that exist. Like, forget about Luke, like, sitting down and being part of the group of Anchorage that's opening the gates there. Like, he'll be walking around in the real world and seeing graffiti that's been left behind, that's been tagged as, you know, having meaning with this virtual world channel that he's part of.
There's your real world achievements.
Hope I get sweet shoulder pads. It's on.
I'm just thinking right now that we're going to be too old to know how to use any of this new technology. Yeah, absolutely. Well, not yet.
We'll be telling crazy stories about Call of Duty and Pac-Man and stuff like that.
I used to lug this box to my friend's house to play split screen.
What's a screen? Split screen, right? That's going to be a concept that's totally gone.
It almost is, right? I mean, it's certainly a dying feature. Interesting.
I'm really under the weather. Sorry for all the coffee.
What do you got? You got the super cancer from Mr. Chief and Arbiter?
I think I just dry throat.
Where's the bubbly?
Yeah, we were going to have champagne. What happened to that?
We're busy. Marty had it in his office.
I thought Marty had the whiskey in his office.
That's Jay, I think. Yeah. I don't know what Marty has in his office, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know.
Some fancy, no doubt. Crystal. Absolutely.
It is an engineering spectacle, though. It's a time and space warp down there. I don't know if you've ever walked in, but time and space literally stop. Next thing you know, you walk out. It's like a different day. 18 hours have gone by. You're not really quite sure what you even talked about. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, you know.
Facts have changed.
You know, people like to joke about Steve Jobs having a reality distortion field, but I think Marty definitely has his own miniature version of something like that.
On that note, I think that we are going to take a break. We thanks, Chris, for coming by. We took an hour instead of a half hour.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I missed all the good stuff.
No,
did you talk about Butchie in the Field?
A little bit.
We touched on Butchie in the Field.
We didn't do too much into that because, like you said when we went to lunch the other day, you thought it was played out. So,
well, as long as Chris had a chance to tell his version of the story, not that Dave Dunn painted a bad picture by any means, but
I think that all things considered, it's even up.
Yeah,
I think as long as our listeners understand that Dave Dunn is kind of like that crazy older brother who'd always have the weird stories. Yeah.
And makes a very ugly woman. No doubt.
I don't have a segue to like a commercial break from he makes a very ugly woman. Like, I just don't. So we're going
to say Luke makes a very pretty woman.
Yeah. We're going to take a break. How do you know? We're going to take a break and we'll be back with a short interview with Major Nelson, actually.
Ooh.
I know.
External guest.
And thanks for coming by, Chris.
Thank you.
consumer, it's you.
Okay, I'll do it one more time.
We're back, and we have a special guest today. It is none other than Major Nelson from Microsoft, also known as Larry Hrib. That's your consumer name, right?
That is. That's what it says on my ID and my driver's license.
How do we pronounce that anyway?
Herb.
Herb.
Yeah, H-R-Y-B.
But it's spelled all backwards, right?
It is. A lot of people spell it H-Y-R-B.
That's something your ancestors got off a crate on the way to Ellis Island,
like,
right?
Is that like Favre being...
Yeah, exactly. Favre. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
No, this is actually when my grandfather's coming over from Russia in Ellis Island.
Right.
In Russian, it's pronounced Herbul.
Right.
And whoever was manning the desk...
Herbuls.
Herbul. And he wrote down H-R-Y-B.
You're one of the Moscow hairballs.
Whoa.
You should be Major Herbul.
So. That's what I was telling you.
Well, you know, I'm not going to tell you what the last name means in Russian either, so we'll just avoid that.
All right, we'll look it up.
This is a mature program.
I got a Cyrillic keyboard. I'm a Cyrillic.
Just go up to Wikipedia. It's up there.
All right.
Yeah, after the last show, we probably have an explicit tag on iTunes, I would say, after the Luke Timmons experience.
Yeah, if you need to let an F-bomb drop,
really?
don't hold back, Major. Yeah.
I just don't want you to get in trouble at work.
Yeah, we don't want to hurt. Okay. Get our image to uphold.
Yeah,
I'll slip it in when no one's looking.
All right.
That's exactly how we roll. Yeah.
And we can go in and add some if you didn't do enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
you can just loop it in. So if I say it once, you can just... That's
no
the beauty
problem.
Of it.
We have a swear board that we just access curses from.
Well, I want to thank you for having me over here because you guys have... I listen to the show a lot and you guys are paving the way because no one else has done this.
It's our pleasure. A couple of weeks ago, actually, we guested on your show.
That's right.
We've been on was Major just, show a couple times over the years. Yeah.
I've had Sketch on. I've had you on. I need to get you on, Luke.
At some point, we'll be able to do that. We just did a...
Luke's a little hurt that you got Frank on again.
We just did a super team.
Is that why he's...
It's in order of as long as you guys have been here, because I've known Sketch long, and then you came along. So we're just... Okay. That's
like, makes sense.
In 4 years,
You'll be on the...
In 4 years.
No, there's another developer podcast. There's a couple of them. They're starting to pop up. Like the Burnout guys did one. Frank and I just guest starred on the Insomniac podcast.
Those guys are great, aren't they?
They're just not as funny as us.
Yeah.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we like to say...
If you say so.
I mean, Major said we paved the way. Let's just take the compliment and move on, all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Though you've been podcasting for a long time now yourself.
When it was still black and white.
Back when it was vinyl.
Yep. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But no, you guys always do a great show. And the one thing I love about this is, my show is so general because, I talk about all the different games, the different platforms. But you guys, you get to talk about... Well, you talk about that as well, but you also have the backdrop of the Halo series, which is just world-renowned.
Well, that's one of the challenges in doing a podcast where you only have one topic to talk about or one studio to talk about. I'm sure the Insomniac guys have that issue as well.
Right.
But we've still got... We've got 1,000 more shows of interesting stuff you never heard before we die. So.
And lots more NFL stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
Dude, people have been really polarized about it.
Yeah, we...
It's really polarizing.
Did you kick up a little dust in the NFL space?
We correctly and logically pronounced that the Patriots were evil and that they should be destroyed. And people in a lot of ways blame us for the Patriots' loss.
Well,
the Super Bowl.
I'm from New England.
Where? Ooh. Oh, really?
Oh, really?
What part of the state? Oh, it was such a good game. God, I wish we could have got Paul Bertone, but he's still not speaking.
I know. I still watch it in my bath in slow motion.
That's
wow,
nice.
So we had to bring in Major Nelson to talk about football.
This, I'm totally the wrong person to talk about.
Yeah, we couldn't
get
Bertone on.
So no, he still hasn't started talking again.
Yeah. So
maybe we should ask the Major about questions that maybe stuff that
I think
our
we should ask him like burning questions
in.
Yeah. About. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, all right. This is a new era.
So
let's
do it then. So you often represent the voice of Microsoft in these matters.
Yeah.
The performance on Xbox Live.
Yep.
Certainly over Christmas, I think
was a little bumpy.
And into January. Yeah. What were the issues? What actually caused it?
There was a couple of issues there. But we've since smoothed them out. I'll just leave it at that.
Right.
Can we play 20 questions where, like, I guess and I get it right on the first time and you say yes?
We can try.
Was it a Russian porno virus?
No.
Damn it.
You took mine, too.
The herb virus?
Yeah.
No.
Hairball virus, yeah. The Russian hairball virus.
So for the most part now, you guys feel like the live experience has smoothed out?
It's back to what people know. I mean, live is like the dial tone. You know, that's when we were growing up with it. We've all been on the service for, since it launched.
Right.
And, when you turn it on, it was always there. And it was a bumpy ride over the holiday. We sold a lot of 360s.
I think was it related at all to a surge in viewer demand for Major's Minute?
It could have been that. That launched, as you know, right.
Across
the beginning of
December. Coincidence?
So I think we just needed the internet had to add more bandwidth.
Right.
So.
I think a lot of people were concerned too, because it seemed like, I mean, the line of messaging was a lot of new consumers, and the result of that messaging is, well, does that mean there's a hard cap on what the service can't handle?
No.
So assuming that, like, all of that's been addressed now.
Oh, absolutely.
Forward.
Absolutely. I mean, you guys know you're a big part of the success. I mean, the Halo 3 title is a huge part of the success, and the Halo 2 title. There's still, as you guys know, there's still a ton of people playing that game.
There is, yeah.
So you guys are really part of our success, along with, you know, Frank and I were talking on my show a couple weeks ago about COD4 and all these great titles that are on the service. So we're well set up for the future.
I think sometimes kids get confused about what a server is and what peer to peer is, and the fact is, once you're in a game, things should be, you know, normalized based on what your internet service provider can do.
Yeah.
But it's the extraneous stuff. It's messaging, it's voicemails, yeah, it's PMs, it's camera stuff. All that stuff has to go through real servers. So you add people, then you're adding a significant amount of bandwidth on those services.
Yeah, when you think about what happens when an app – so we all have full friends lists, but you think about the transactions that are happening every single second in terms of, this is the game that they're playing, this mm-hmm. is the level they're playing. We call it rich presence. Mm-hmm. If you think of all those different transactions that's happening just with one person – then you go to your entire friends list of 100 people, right, and then you go across the entire service of 10 million people. That's a lot of little bits of data flying around every single second.
Yeah, and it's I mean, my biggest frustration with live is when the messaging is going slow and you're trying to delete, you know, invites and stuff, and you just get that little bit of lag, mm-hmm. and it's hard to tell whether that's something that's happening local on your box or whether it's related to network, and it usually is, you know, it's network conditions.
Yeah, couple issues there that. Yeah, you're right. It's tough. The networking code is, and you guys know, good networking code is tough.
Yep.
Writing games is tough. You guys know that. But I know that our team has really looked at how to make that a better experience. And that's what we're going to be doing moving forward. Is the Xbox Live is the gold standard, and it's going to continue to be.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into our competition in that field, but like comparing it to there's nothing to compare to. I can't compare it feature for feature with any other service because nobody else has these things. So,
right.
You know, it's easy to complain about, but you can't do it anywhere else. So.
Well, you mean nobody else has these things in the console space, right?
Like, yeah, obviously. Yeah, I mean, okay. if you're sending a PC, you can message.
Yeah, we get people talking about Steam, I'm trying to protect you, Frank.
Yeah, thanks from the hate mails. No, I mean, I'm a PS3 owner, for example, and I can't do all those same things in the PS3 XMB yet.
Yeah.
I'm sure those guys are working on it, but I can't do it yet, so it's not. No comparison.
Yeah.
Same with Wii.
So do you have your friends list setting to everyone, friends only, or blocked for voice and text?
Everyone.
So how many messages do you get a night?
Well, as you can hold 100 messages, and I usually clear them off once or twice a day, and it's usually, you know, 90, 95. So it's always about 90 to 95% full.
It's a constant.
Yeah. Constant.
Do you reply to all those people?
I read them all, but some of the ones I reply to, but some of the ones just don't, like... Hey, can you tell me what games you're playing? Yeah, how about you look at my gamer card? You know, just you.
Oh, snap!
Yeah, we get
dirty.
We get those all the time. But you know, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, I did a major's minute on how to send a photo message. I don't know if you've seen that one. You know, just using the camera. Here's how you do it. I did it for Valentine's Day a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, did you get my picture I sent you?
Well, I did
it's
not.
Called I sat in gum.
I did not, but.
Oh my God! But you did say
always,
gum, right?
I'm always scared to open those, and yet it has always been something. It's never been anything awful yet. So,
what I was trying to say is that a lot of people, since they saw that, they're like, "Hey, Major, here's my photo of my insert body part here."
Right.
Since you showed me how to do this, so I actually incited people to send me photos that probably shouldn't be reproduced.
Oh dear.
From people who probably shouldn't reproduce.
Right? Yeah.
I wish you could forward messages because I get some howlers sometimes that I want to share with my friends.
But I wish you could just differentiate between the way you interact with people in the guide experience versus in the game experience. And, you know, I've pulled Larry's aside many times and I've been poking him. And I know, you know, obviously you're a high-profile gamer tag as well. You should probably share the same issue where... If you set yourself to friends only, which is nice because it prevents you from having 100 messages a day to wade through, but then it therefore means you can't talk to any non-friends in the game. And you might just want to play big team battle and be social and be friendly.
And
but
have
you,
fun,
can't,
yeah.
you can't
yeah.
do that. And it always seemed really weird that it would be sort of an all or nothing commitment. I ideally would be awesome if we had two levels of control. Is at the meta level, I want people outside the game to have this type of access, and then in the game, I'm okay saying that I can say good game after a match.
Right, right.
Do you think that? And this probably maybe doesn't apply to 99% of the people that listen to the podcast and that actually
right,
play.
I know. That's why I stopped complaining about it, is because not many people get 100
messages.
For the
four of us in this room.
Four of us sitting at this table.
We would really love to see that happen someday. Yeah,
there's actually there's like about a dozen features that I have requested, and that's one of that's one of them. There's a few around achievements that I've made requests for. Yeah, it's how do we manage our messages better? Because we definitely need to do that. And I remember when we were designing the Xbox 360 and the whole messaging experience, we're like, well, do we combine it so that it's in your Hotmail, you know, so that you had like all your live messages were with your Hotmail, and we're like, no, because then there's going to be spam. Right. So it was like we stretched to figure out what was the best way to do it, because we didn't want to recreate, because the last thing anybody needs is another email box, right? Because everyone's got Gmail and Yahoo and Hotmail. So who's that just running by? What was that?
There's an engineer. That's how they do things. They run.
Oh, okay.
That data runs from where they had the idea straight to a keyboard. That's probably some sweet networking.
We move
code
at a fast pace around here.
I noticed that. So
not,
anyway.
Not us, but everybody else.
Yeah. So yeah, I totally agree with you, Sketch. It's something that we need to do is figure out how to make the messaging, because messaging is, to what you were saying earlier, Frankie, is such a critical core component of the Xbox Live experience.
Yeah. I mean, I understand how it's hard to prioritize something like that, because it probably does impact such a small amount of the population. Yeah. But then again, it doesn't seem like it'd be that hard to do either. Speaking of features, and the other thing that I think we hear a lot, which again doesn't maybe apply to the majority of users. But do you ever think there'd be a chance that they would increase the amount of people that could be on a friends list from above beyond 100?
Well, we would like to do that, but the problem is that, like yourselves as game developers, that's less resources to put more grunts on the screen, or you know, to put more things on the screen, because we're only allowed, the dashboard and the guide is only allowed so much memory space and so much CPU space, and then the rest of it's, you know, we want to make sure that you as the developers have as much as you can do. Now, I will say this. I have seen some test scenarios where they are experimenting with some interesting ideas.
Yeah, because you like hedged a little bit there, and there's the whole tie to MSN Messenger now, where you can have like a second friends list sort of if you want to tie your Messenger thing to it.
And then there's the friends of friends, where if you have, like, I gave Tycho the idea, you know, he announced it, you know, a couple months ago when we rolled that out, was just have like, you know, Major's clan as a friend on your friend, and then you can see through that all your people on your clan friends. So there's creative ways to do it. I'm not going to say no, never. Because I have seen some scary things that these guys are working on. When they said, well, how about we increase the friends list to this number? And it was a scary number that made me fall off my chair. That would probably make you guys fall off
your chair. I actually never really considered like the resource limitations. I mean, that's interesting that you bring that up. I always just assumed it was like a social usability concern.
Well, if you think about what it's doing, it's pinging the server, finding out how many friends you've got, what their names are, whether they're online or not, whether they're in a game or not. It's a lot of information.
What
it's
they're doing
go grab
in that game. Yeah. The other thing is the average number of friends – because we know we can do a query is about 25. So across all 10 million people on Xbox Live, the average number of friends is 25.
Losers.
Lucky guys.
Yeah, I know.
Must be nice.
Yeah. What about I never got my free copy of Puzzle Quest. I missed out on that whole little.
This is
a good.
You mean Undertow?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Undertow.
Puzzle Quest. You're right. No, I got a Puzzle Quest somewhere else. I'm sorry. That was something totally different. Yeah. No. Remember at Child's Play?
Yeah,
it was
right.
It was something that Larry helped
that's
offer
right.
up. You're right.
That's
no,
right.
It was Undertow.
Right.
If people missed out, you kind of screwed, huh?
No, all they had to do was call support.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and
they'll give me a code?
And yeah,
they'll just verify that I don't have it. And
yeah, that you don't have it, they'll take care of it.
There you go.
That's pretty cool.
I missed out.
Yeah.
We should talk about support a little bit. I don't know how tied you are to it, but we've seen a lot of issues popping up on our end with people trying to social engineer prizes and treats away from our community.
Yeah. So rule number one, kids, some of this you have to take responsibility for. Don't make your password obvious. Don't keep your password in a public place. If your password is your pet's first name, get that off your MySpace page. This is how kids find a lot of this information. You should try and keep your identity as private and secure as possible in everywhere that you have a presence. It doesn't take much of a Google search to find out a lot of information about people. Keep it quiet, keep it secret, keep it private. And if your pet, you know, if the question is, what is my pet's name? you know, pick a thing that isn't your pet. Just use a mnemonic to remember what it is that the answer is.
But nobody from Microsoft or Live would ever ask an Xbox Live member what their password.
Absolutely never. Not.
Or your credit Absolutely card not. Number. Absolutely or, you not. Know, they, you know, they'll ask you for your name, and that's about it, yeah. right? So
that's it. I mean, and Frank, you're absolutely right, because, I mean, everybody around this table, we're high profile. Fortunately, we haven't had our I haven't had my account taken over by social engineering.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that guys like Frankie and me and right. Sketch and you are high profile targets right. who would be terrorized by such things.
Right. But we
let's not plan any ideas.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's head to that whole part. Yeah.
But you know, it is important to protect your information. And Frank, you bring up some great points. Is that it's. You know, that friend you have at school who you recovered your account over at his house, don't mess around with his girlfriend and piss him off.
Yeah. I mean, I would, if I had access to your email, I would read it.
Right.
And I'm a good person, but I would read it and I would send mails from it.
Right.
So to executives.
Microsoft all.
Yeah. This is about Travis. But yeah, you need to keep a lid on your information, and also you need to understand what 1-800-MY-XBOX is capable of and what they're not capable of as well. So,
well, if you call 1-800-MY-XBOX, you're not going to get through.
Well,
to anyone.
What is it, 4-MY-XBOX?
Yeah,
exactly.
So, want to make sure we're giving out correct information.
That is correct. Yeah,
exactly.
Luke, always keeping Frank in line.
Nice work.
Thanks, Luke.
Uh-huh. Hey, you're welcome.
Are you able to give us any indications of, by this point, GDC has already happened, and
yeah.
I'm sure there were some exciting things going on down there, but like, what can we look forward to? Like, what are you, any hints at maybe what's next big thing that might happen for Xbox Live?
I think it's going to be a great year. I mean, we thought 2007 was a great year with all the great titles.
The best year ever, I believe, Microsoft.
Yeah, best year for at least two or three, 4 years, yeah.
Yeah, ever. So I think this year it is now what are we now in our junior year? You know, if you think of sophomore and freshman. And so
oh right. All the console business getting out of it after graduation senior year. Heard it here first.
What I'm saying is we're now at the point where
fifth year senior.
Senioritis.
See, that's how things. That's how.
And Kotaku, that's the thing, right? The like, I just feel joysticks traffic for a month. Deal with it.
What you're going to see this year is some really neat changes that we're working on. We're to Sketch's point about making the experience better and better over Xbox Live. You know, sure, you're always going to be able to connect and so on and so forth, but we're looking at how can we make that experience better, and what can we do to make it even more approachable for people.
Well, there's some big games coming too. I mean, Gears of War 2 will have been announced by the time this podcast goes out for sure.
Yep.
Cliffy will have done his thing at GDC with his chainsaw.
Yeah.
The thing that I was interested in though is Zune Gaming.
Yeah. Like, isn't that great?
It makes everything sort of makes sense now. You look at that controller, the way it's set up.
Right.
What kind of games can we expect on the Zune?
Right.
Obviously,
now it's
simple stuff.
It's a developer, as I understand it, it's a developer only feature. They're just testing it right now, and then hopefully towards the end of the year, you know, the game that you write next in a game studio, you're going to be able to, you know, I don't know exactly how it works. I don't think it's as simple as file export Zune, but they're going to be able to bring them over to the Zune so you can play, you can author and play games on the Zune.
The promise of Live Anywhere delivered.
Yeah. So,
well, what about, I mean, I would love to be able to take my Marketplace content and also move it to my Zune.
Yeah, you know, Frank and I talked about that before we started recording. I would too.
Yeah, who wouldn't?
Who wouldn't, right?
Yeah. I can only imagine there's just all sorts of rights and royalty issues to sort out. But, I mean, it seems like the last big dot that hasn't been connected that would be a win for all the products and services. I don't know.
I was saying I'd like to make my 360 that hub. Like, that's where I'd like to rip my CDs to. That's where I'd like to buy my music from. That's where I'd like to get my movies from. And if I could rent the HD version of something, I'd pay a little premium to get a portable version of Watch 2.
Yeah.
I mean, that'd be really cool.
I talked to Jay about this back in November when I had him on my show. And he knows that that's what we need to do. And it's just a matter of getting there. And as you guys know, it takes a long time to sort out the business issues, the legal issues.
Well, that's the thing. We always get pinged for DRM issues. DRM isn't the Xbox's invention. That's the studios and the music copyright holders.
It's the industry.
That's the industry. That's how they like to protect things. And it is difficult for a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time to get around all these hurdles.
I mean, you know, Frank, you're a writer. You want to make sure your content's protected.
Not really. I just send out Word documents willy-nilly.
Okay, well, there you go. Okay, never mind then. So yeah, it's a challenge, and the entire industry wrestles with this all the time.
Right.
You know, it's a
but tough. It seems to me like it's a battle between making it easy and fun for people to enjoy content and absolutely preventing them from enjoying content.
Right.
And the two things obviously are at odds with each other.
Right.
So yeah, it's interesting to see people when they blame Microsoft or they blame Apple for the difficulty of watching or listening to something on a device.
Yeah.
As sort of the central engineer driving like the Microsoft hype train, because you are like a forward-facing personality.
You are the engineer on that.
Yeah. How do you feel about Microsoft's strategy of not really talking about 2008 until 2008? Like a bunch of presentations last year were way more forward-thinking and looking further ahead. Microsoft chose to focus on the present, and now with the NPD sales in January, like the 360's in last place. Is this some sort of a sign of maybe 2008 wasn't talked about enough? I mean, strategically, that seems like a bit odd.
Hindsight's always 2020.
Well, people were saying it at the
time.
Yeah,
we were saying
though,
it in 2007.
So it was more like Palpatinian prophetics.
Right. Okay. Everything is proceeding exactly as Luke has foreseen.
Is it?
Precisely.
Well, it's, you know, I'm not close to those conversations, and I know that a lot of people were, you know, yourselves included, and were like, "Well, what's going on for 2008?" And here we are now. We're now a couple months into 2008. And the fact of the matter is that we wanted to talk about all those great games because it best holiday ever. But it's now that that's behind us, I don't have an answer for that. I really don't. You know, I haven't really thought about it in a couple months.
Yeah.
Let me get back to you on that.
So, when are you guys going to announce the new SKU? I mean, the retail channels have been emptied.
They're unstuffed.
The premium's nowhere to be found.
They've purged.
Yeah. And now there's no consoles to buy. What's the deal?
Well, by the time this airs, which is, you know, was it a couple months after we record it, right, there'll be lots of consoles back in the channel.
So you're saying that we're just recovering from the best holiday ever.
Yeah, that's
put a little strain on the supply
chain.
That's
what the numbers have told me. Luke, you talked about the January numbers not being so good. Because because we're just coming off this high, and you know, making consoles hardware is kind of hard.
It's like the refractory period, and someone's in the other room making a sandwich.
Right, exactly. So January is sandwich making time.
Yeah, and what was it? We did 240,000 in January,
something like that.
That's a good January, to be honest, right? For a premium item like that.
Mm, yeah.
Just that PS3 and Wii had better Januaries.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean the PS3, they're both great. You know, the Wii still has they're still. Are they creating their artificial shortage or not? You know, who knows? But, you know, they still got a great – they got great momentum. The PS3 is finally coming into its sophomore year, you know, so it's finally getting maybe a couple of titles there that are pretty good. And of course, there's the whole HD DVD Blu-ray. A lot of people think that really provided the bump on the PS3 side, that HD DVD maybe isn't doing so well in the Blu-ray – you know, all the studios are in the Blu-ray camp, so –
Yeah, there was certainly a lot of noise on the internet about it. I wouldn't be surprised if that translated in a couple of tens of thousands of units sold from people who were fence-sitting on that matter. Yeah. But it's hard to say. We'll know.
It's still a tight – if you look at the numbers, I mean, they're
good. Still close.
Yeah, 20,000, 30,000. Which
big spring coming up, though. I mean, on the eve of Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
Yeah, Grand Theft Auto. We've got
Two Human, Halo Legendary.
Well, you had Mr. Don Matrick on your show about 3 weeks ago, talking about Grand Theft Auto, and said that it's going to have exclusive downloadable content.
Yep.
But he also rolled into that phrase that it would have exclusive online multiplayer component. Is true, or did he misspeak?
It was actually the way Don. You have to understand. I mean, you guys have all chatted with Don, I assume.
He hasn't come on yet.
No, we need to get him on here. We sucked up to him for like 5 weeks and then nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
So the way he kind of phrased it, that's why I had to provide the clarification. It's, you know, the online content, the episodic content is exclusive.
Is the exclusive part.
Which is coming apparently in the fall.
Yeah.
Which will be, you know, so we'll have all summer long to play some GTA.
Yeah.
Get our GTA on.
Looking forward to it.
You looking forward to that?
No, but the thing about the GTA games is I've bought every single one of them, and I just – it's like Frank with achievements where Frank can't get anything done.
Right.
There's just so much to do where I'll play for like 2 hours, and then I'll put a bunch of cars in a circle, get a bunch of people near them, kill everyone, and be like, all right, cool, I'm done.
So but I never get bored of going back in. It's like Crackdown. I never got tired. Like, I wasn't doing anything, and I wasn't playing it in a linear fashion, but I just love tooling around in there.
So
I feel like that about Grand Theft Auto. I just love going in and – I'm going to ride around on a moped for no reason at all.
I'll never finish it. I accept that right now.
It's
I'll
unfinishable
never, ever
for people
it,
with
but it'll be a fun romp for a while.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it is what it is. It's an open sandbox. Let's go in and have some fun. And you know, I'm going to be interested to see what the achievements look like.
Yeah.
That'll always be interesting.
I get the sense you're really into achievements, huh?
Yeah.
Well,
it seems to be something that, I mean, I guess you're expected to have a very high gamer score, right?
Yeah, I'm it's at sort 15. Of a, it's, I'm
you like, need the street cred.
Yeah, well, it's unlike Frank, I like to play the game. Sometimes I like to finish them.
Well, but do you admit that you occasionally go out of your way to play a game solely based on achievements that you would never otherwise play?
Avatar. If you, okay. I say that I have 15,500 gamer score, but I put an asterisk next to that. It's actually 14,500.
That's the only game, though, that
don't you don't have assistants play games for you?
No.
That's what I heard. That's what everyone does. No. All the kids.
The
do
only thing.
Now.
The only time
that's
I've ever done something
you got
remotely
KP cranking out achievements for
actually,
you.
Actually, I got a stack of discs for you, Luke, to take home.
The only thing I've ever done close to that is because I'm famously bad at Guitar Hero and Rock Band.
Yeah.
Is I left Guitar Hero in my office logged in one day, so people just as I was sitting at my desk working, people would come by and pick it up and play, and all of a sudden, you know,
and they were good.
Later.
Actually, maybe somebody will socially steal Frank's account and boost your gamer score and give it back to you.
Yeah.
I like my low score.
It's 1500. That's a challenge. I mean,
I thought you just had another real account that's private. That's where you play.
Oh yeah, I have like 80,000 gamer score
yeah,
on that
that's
one.
What I thought. You're maxed out.
Yeah, that's for reals.
But to your point, yeah, I think gamer score it just adds another dimension to the game.
Sure, I mean, if given the choice to play a game that I get a score and a game I don't, I'll always play the one.
You always want to opt
score,
for that, so that's why I'm just interested to see you guys did such a. You guys did a really great job with achievements, just in terms of metering them out and you know, having the right mix of multiplayer versus single player, and it's hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I think maybe a few of us in retrospect might feel that ours. People just earn them all too fast,
right.
And you know, if we could do it over again, we might have wanted to extend some of those. Maybe
it's hard
tougher,
to say because it did what we set out.
Statistically, though, they're pretty well distributed, and a lot of people have them. A lot of people are still working on them, but
yeah.
You know, certainly that hardcore group, I think,
yeah, they're going to burn
in
through
a matter
them.
Of a day or
yeah.
two. You know, had well, pretty much gotten everything.
Well,
I
mean, that's
to
the
get.
Power of the language filter, which is the thing. Like, there's no, it's really hard to assess. How many people, you know, completed all the achievements in Halo 3, not because of the 1,000 gamer score, but because there were ways to game it. And because there were ways to game it, we never really got a good sense of, okay, well, that overkill achievement in Lone Wolves was too hard to get because only this percent of people got it despite the population numbers in
right.
Lone Wolves. Instead, it was people go in and cheat. So in terms of being able to assess it, it hasn't been, like, the greatest resource ever.
But we did discover that people played our campaign more than they did in Halo 2 and more of it. And that's
right.
one of the primary things we set out to achieve. So in some ways, yeah. it's been really successful.
Do you think that's because of the achievements or is it because of that you guys had co-op?
Both.
You have co-op
both
over
and
live.
Co-op. Co-op is an assistant to getting some of the achievements.
Yeah.
It helps you explore areas. It helps you find things that you want to do and get.
Yeah.
I think they go hand in hand.
Yeah, I remember actually.
I know what you're talking about.
I'll go ahead and say Luke took me out on an achievement run once. And
we found that one skull together. That was fun.
That was a very special, yeah. touching moment.
Pop tent achievement.
That's the moment we decided to grow dual beards.
yeah. Nothing's been the same.
To commemorate that time we spent on the art.
Yeah.
I think we're just about out of time. We just had Paul Bertone swing by and he motioned to us.
We have a top secret playtest in 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of, we're pretty close from our next map release by the time this podcast comes out. We got the Legendary Pack still headed out this spring.
Yep.
Which prior to that, we'll have the original maps, 3 maps becoming free.
Yep.
So, and that reminds me, I think when I was on your show a while back, we sort of threw a gauntlet down that we've yet to actually follow through on. And this goes back to a long-standing rivalry between...
This goes back to 2004, doesn't it?
Our group and Larry's group and a little Halo smack talking.
Yeah.
And obviously you've taken some steps since then. You've hired
doubles.
KP for the sole purpose of boosting your team's skill.
Sure.
But we definitely owe a rematch there.
So KP played on the HBO team, so he technically can't play on Major Nelson's
team. Oh, too bad, too
bad.
So
it'll have to be like Major,
it's
Trixie,
to be you, Trixie.
He does work on the team, so it's...
I'm afraid we have a rule in place.
So do Eamon and Joe.
So can I take a look at the rules, please? I'd like to...
Oh, those are a part of the story Bible.
Are those...
Luke, you heard that whole story, though, right? About the fateful match and
no,
the
what whole, happened?
All the aftermath, and we sort of pulled a prank on Larry and pseudo hacked his website, and then he sent us a bouquet of dead flowers to mourn our loss. And yeah, it was.
See, Frank always tells me that if I lose, I'm just supposed to lie and cheat and say that I won.
Yeah.
But we don't really lose now, so
it's true. It is a new regime.
Yeah, I actually have heard that you have put together quite a team.
Yeah, we actually have. Like,
basically, we're not on it.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah, but it's good.
We played the guys from McFarlane Toys a few weeks ago, and way overstaffed. Like, we beat them like 50-12.
Well, you guys destroyed the Bengals, right?
We destroyed the Bengals. We've been beat by some pretty good people, and by the time this airs, people will know about we're going to play a bunch of the best teams from MLG, and we're going to get
ours. Yeah, we're just going in there to get spanked on purpose.
I want to be plundered by Final Boss.
Okay.
I want to shoot his flashing red part.
I kind of think that we should look for the once we have more details about Legendary Map Pack release, that will, on the eve of that release, yep. I think that's when we should play.
Now, I would like to do this because we talked about this a little bit earlier, is, you know, we have this new venue, this new video thing inside Xbox. You know, I'd love to maybe we can bring the inside Xbox cameras over.
Yeah, let's do it.
And maybe we should do it. Maybe we should do it in person. I don't know.
You mean like to cover this challenge? Yeah. I like it.
Our new building, I was informed yesterday, would have such functionality.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah,
right.
So we could definitely do something.
Yeah,
live.
People would like, and then people could go online, watch the film of the game, and sort of just relive it all.
Yeah.
And just to clarify, we're not moving. We're just expanding.
Yeah.
That's true.
Are you taking the pancake house out?
No.
We just need a slot window to their kitchen.
It's like right up the street. We have another small space. Primarily, I think, is going to house contract staff and support as we balloon up.
Here we grow again.
Well, I mean, you saw on the way in, we're pretty crammed in here right now. Well,
I couldn't see that much because I was blindfolded.
Yeah, good. Good, Frank. You did that? All right.
Frank just did it with his hands, though. It was kind of gross.
It was kind of sweaty. It was gamey.
Sweet perfume.
Well, I want to just thank you guys for having me over here. It was a real blast, and you know, it's always fun to come over here and just to talk, you know, just to talk about games and what you guys are doing.
Yeah, I always like listening to Frank talk about games.
Exactly,
it's a real treat.
It's such a deep conversation. And I hear you're playing Castlevania. Which one?
Rondel of Blood. What do I call it? It's the one with Symphony of Night unlockable.
Okay.
Yeah.
Available for the Sony PlayStation Portable.
Yes, exactly. You guys are haters.
we'll have Luke talk to your people. We'll get a match set up. We'll make this happen.
We'll get some video on it, and we'll have
and then
some
we'll
fun.
We'll talk again afterwards and see how it goes.
Do you guys have the ability to like bleep and edit out an inside Xbox videos?
You're gonna need.
Oh yeah, our team is not kid friendly. This is an after hours.
I share inside Xbox with Trixie, so anybody who knows her knows that she has her own bleep.
Potty mouth. And we're a mature rated game, so it's only to be expected.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, we'll work on that.
All right, sounds good.
Thanks for coming back.
Thank you, Major.
Yeah, thanks, Major, and we'll be back in a couple weeks. Bungie Studios podcast is mixed and mastered by Steve Lopez, produced by Tom Giaconda and Chris Gossett, and hosted by Brian Gerard, Frank O'Connor, Luke Smith, and Bungie Studios.